The suggestion was that we speak this evening about the problem of intermarriage, marriage between a Jew and a non-Jew. First of all, it was decided that we usually have a dialogue or discussion on Sunday evenings, and we set aside Mondays for a formal presentation without any discussion. And we decided that because of the nature of the subject, people may wish to ask questions, and so I'll leave time at the end and let me ask you to note down questions that you have, and you are free to ask at the end. If you don't feel able to, then you can write your question down if you wish and send it up in written form if you want to be anonymous. We'll do my best to deal with any questions or comments. I can't imagine a more difficult subject to have to speak about. And if you want my personal feeling, I feel almost hopeless about discussing such a subject, because it's my personal feeling that anyone who understands the subject doesn't need any details to be spoken out. Anybody who knows what it means for a Jew to marry a non-Jew and how impossible that is filled with an overwhelming feeling of the impossibility of such a thing. And no amount of halakhic reasoning or details makes any difference. And for those who don't understand it, I can't see how any talk about it is going to make any difference. Because this is something that's at the deepest level of the spiritual bloodstream of a Jewish mind. The authorities who write about it say that before any proofs, a Jew should know that you just cannot do this thing. But let's try anyway. Maybe let's start like this. To try and understand, and I would like to make it clear that I'm not here personally to insult anybody or judge anyone who was brought up with less Jewish knowledge, maybe, or consciousness than somebody else. The fact that I personally can't understand such a thing, we'll try and put aside for now. But I'd like to try and make the whole area as explicit as possible and try my best to be as practical as possible. That means that if people find themselves in such a situation and perhaps are becoming more conscientized, more aware, and they want to change, I'd like to try and indicate practical avenues of trying to make a difference, including what one should do if one's connected with such people in one's family, and try and leave time for practical, hopefully helpful discussion as well. Maybe let's start like this. To understand this subject properly, there are two basic issues that have to be understood, neither of which we can go into fully, but let's try and just in overview look at these two issues. One is, and let me preface this preface by saying that there are cassettes available, recordings available in the library here that deal with each of these two subjects in much more detail. And anyone who really wants to get a gut level insight into this overall subject needs to research these two areas in much more detail. And those two areas are the difference between a Jew and a non-Jew, what it means to have a Jewish neshama, and what it means to have a non-Jewish soul. And the second is, what is the meaning of the idea of marriage altogether? Because if one understood clearly the concept of a Jewish identity, what it means, what that spiritual reality is, and what a non-Jewish identity is in spiritual terms, and in addition, if one understood what marriage is supposed to be, then the rest of the discussion would be superfluous. Because one would see that there are two types of being that never can be melted into one spiritually. Two bodies can live in proximity, just like animals can have a biological relationship. But no spiritual bond can ever be formed between a Jew and a non-Jew. Let's see if we can try and approach this without the prejudice of trying to hear in these words that Jews are better than non-Jews. We're not saying that Jews are better than non-Jews. It doesn't say anywhere that that's so. And that's not the basis of this discussion. To get anywhere in this discussion, a lot of prejudice is going to have to be put aside. I'm doing my best to speak to those people who need the discussion. Those who don't need it, I don't think it makes much difference. Those who need the discussion, tremendous amount of unconscious streams in the personality need to be
exposed and put aside. But let's try and do it that way. Let me ask you to keep your questions till the end and stay tuned to a wavelength that you may not be familiar with using. Let's start like this. In overview, the difference between Jew and non-Jew, without any judgmental level at all, if you really want to go into whether Jew or non-Jew are better, which of us is better living up to our spiritual responsibilities in the world, that's very debatable. And that is a discussion. Who's got a better track record of living up to spiritual obligations? Who's got a track record of tolerance and who doesn't? And who's got a better track record of torture and cruelty? And who's been held to their standards, who can be held to their standards directly, and who can't be, that's another discussion. And it's probably an impossible discussion. But what it means at rock bottom to be Jew, to be a Jew and to be a non-Jew, in non-judgmental terms, is something like this. The only source that we have for this idea, all the sources for this idea are Kabbalistic. That means that the whole discussion is based on an understanding that's above, or beneath if you like, the level of the conscious. There's no explicit difference that you can point to between Jew and a non-Jew. The Gemara does say that the difference between a Jewish soul and a non-Jewish soul is so deep that it reflects itself in biological differences. There are biological differences. Exactly what they are is not clear. The Gemara suggests a few that we know to be different and has some question about how these biological differences operate, which is not entirely a serious discussion. But it's clear that the nature of a lifestyle that stems from the spiritual reality even reflects itself in the body. But the depth of this subject is not biological or physical. The depth is in the level of what the identity of the soul is, and that is a spiritual and transcendent subject. But as best we can put it in a few words, we have the idea that Jews and non-Jews are the development of different roots in the human existence. The Kabbalistic sources say that in Adam, in Adam HaRishon, the first man who ever lived, was a bonding of all soul elements into one. In fact, not only was there a bonding of what would later become non-Jewish elements and what would later become so-called Jewish elements, but there was a bonding of male and female too. There was a complete reflection of the oneness of the transcendent world in that human being. One of his faces, he was born, was created with two facets. He had a side of his body that was male and he had a side that was female. There was no back to his body. And that's not only a Kabbalistic idea, that's an explicit idea. And then to enable them, if you like, him or them, to have the experience of melting back into oneness through their own effort, they were torn apart as man and woman, who then had a back exposed, which is the negative and lonely side, and then given the job of melting back the hard way into oneness again. But in that way, or in something like that, he had contained within him certain elements that had certain functions that were the Jewish root, let's say, and certain elements that had certain other functions that were the non-Jewish root. Had he not done what he did, there never would have been a separation. Had he succeeded in living for the next few hours after his creation until that Friday night, until that Shabbos would have been ushered in, he would have been, or they would have been, one perfect being, and there would have been no need for suffering, and there would have been no need for the pathway of history. But that didn't happen. And because of the state of having fallen or changed from what he was before to what he was afterwards, then were liberated from his consciousness and from his mind and from his body, two different types of streams of being, many more than two as well. But we're focusing now only on the difference between that stream which later became called the Jewish element of being, elemental existence, and that which became the non-Jewish world. The Kabbalistic idea is that at a high level of existence, things can be done as a oneness. Opposites can be fused into oneness and function as oneness, which is what the final revelation of the world's spiritual history will be. But at a lower level, opposites cannot hold together. And the only way they can live in harmony is by pulling apart and each one contributing to the center what needs to be given to the center. And therefore, one of the corrections, one of the breakdowns, and therefore one of the corrections of the pathway of history was that there would be formed two kinds of human element, which would each be entrusted with a different job entirely. One being what we came to be called, or to become, the Jewish nation, and one, the rest of the world, non-Jewish nations. Even in non-Kabbalistic sources and explicit sources trace a gzeira, which means a rabbinic decree, dated to the time of the Beis Midrash, or the Beis Din of Shem. Shem was one of the sons of Noah, of Noah. Long before the Jewish nation ever came into existence, there was a decree issued by his Beis Din that Jew and non-Jew should not marry. There weren't Jews and non-Jews at that stage. They were only the seed of what would later become the Jewish people, as enshrined in Shem himself, one of the three sons of Noah, and later his descendant Abraham, Avram Avinu, and so forth. But even at that nuclear stage, before the Jewish people had been manifest as the nation that we know today, there was already a decree prohibiting intermarriage between that lineage and all other peoples on earth. Which means that it's not just an enactment of national significance. It is the deepest kind of intrinsic existence in the neshama that there could be, dating well back before there was any form of national existence. What are the two elements, the two types of soul function that we have to fulfill in the world as Jews and non-Jews respectively? We don't have time this evening certainly to go into this in detail, but if you like, just a hint at the subject, and again I refer you to a full discussion of this. I think the recording is called, there's one called Jew and Non-Jew, and there's another recording called Jews in Non-Jewish Society. Those two recordings together analyze much more fully the subject. But briefly, the idea is that the two elements that were needed to bring the world into harmony, the mystics express as male and female, meaning Jews and non-Jews as male and female elements. The female elements, namely the non-Jewish nations, are given the function of building the practical reality of the world. They have the function, the incredible challenge, to build the world in its physical and aesthetic sense. The Jewish nation, originally, were designed not to work on the physical and aesthetic, but to make the connection between the perfected physical situation and the spiritual source. If you like, it was to be the connection between the mind and the body. If you like, the Jewish neshama was designed to be that which brings the spark of electricity from the source into the created level, and the non-Jewish neshama was created and given the talent to be able to perfect the explicit and physical level so that a perfect marriage could be formed between them. There are many sources for this. One of the classic sources is the deeper discussion of the idea of the birth of Jacob and Esau, Yaakov and Esav, who were twins, as you'll recall. That's how close we are to each other, born as twins, which means given a twin function from the same parents, given a twin function, each of us having to complement the other's function in perfection. Of course, we're not doing that, and there's hardly been a time in history when we've done that, but that was the original design. Esav was a man who was incredibly powerful physically, and he was given the job of perfecting the physical world. His later descendants became people who were gifted both physically and aesthetically. The whole Greek and Roman legacy is quite explicitly stated, even in Chumash. At the beginning of time, he stated that at the end of time, that aesthetic and physical beauty will reside in the spiritual tents of the Jewish people. That means there will be a marriage or a harmony between the non-Jewish construction, what the non-Jews, or the non-Jewish element, the construction of physical aesthetic. Aesthetics means beauty and harmony within the physical. That will find its residence, its harmony, with the spiritual being, which is what the Jewish people put into the world. I'm sincerely hoping that you are able to hear, even at this stage of the discussion, that we're not talking about better or worse. Anybody who has the prejudice when speaking about male and female, that one is better or worse, is completely outside of the subject. We're talking about a harmony where both elements are essential. When we speak about Jew and non-Jew, we're speaking about two elements that are essential. Without an aesthetic, without a body that's aesthetically perfected, there's nothing to put a soul into. Without a physical world that's built correctly by the non-Jewish nations, there's nothing to invest in spirituality. And a shaman is useless without a body. Just a potential. And of course, a physical existence that is not suffused with a spiritual reality, of course, is a corpse. Which means that if the world functions on non-Jewish lines entirely, even if they do their job properly and we don't put spirituality in, so then you have a world that's a rotting corpse. And if you have the Jewish people trying to put spirituality in, but no one's taking care of the physical structure, so then you have a potential neshama that hasn't got a place to reside. Obviously, we have to function in harmony. The point is that we're not functioning in harmony, and the relationship broke down right at the beginning with Yaakov and Esav. Esav got stuck into the physical for its own sake, and not to provide a vehicle and a base for spirituality. And for that reason, it says in many sources that the non-Jews were denied their opportunity thereafter to function as a critically important element in building physicality, and some of that was given to the Jewish people. Because the non-Jewish nations got involved in physicality not for an ulterior motive, which makes it beautiful, but for its own sake, when Esav started taking advantage of physicality, and of course it's a tremendous ordeal, in many ways it's a more difficult ordeal than spiritual ordeal, and that's why he was given such tremendous power. So Esav forfeited his right to the spiritual potency that he needed to do that job, the blessings that he was given, the power that he was given to fulfill that function in life was the Bechera, being the firstborn. We were only born, we were to be the secondborn, he was to be the leader, the firstborn. And he was given the blessings of his father, and he was given a woman much higher spiritually than Jacob was given. Leah, Rachel and Leah, two sisters, again sisters, who were meant to marry two brothers. Esav was meant to marry Leah, and Jacob was meant to marry Rachel. But Leah was on a much higher spiritual plane. The mystics say that she begins above the head of the level of where Rachel stands, whatever that means. And she was a woman of the kind of power who could have matched up to an Esav, and between them they could have perfected the world. But when Esav got involved in physicality for his own sake, so he was obviously, what Hashem did was deny him and wrest away from him the power and potency that he needed to do that job, because he wasn't doing that job. And therefore the right of the firstborn was sold by him to his brother Yaakov, and the blessings that were intended for him were diverted to Yaakov so that he could do that job, and the woman that was meant for Esav was diverted, and she had to marry Yaakov as well, so he ended up marrying both of them so that he could have the tools to fulfill both functions. After that, it says the non-Jews were left with a different version of the same role of being involved in physicality. In case you think that there's a value judgment here, and you start feeling that maybe we hung on to our role and they divested themselves of theirs, you unfortunately, your attention is drawn to the current state of the Jewish people. And you have to ask yourself the question about whether we're fulfilling our role. If you need to be reminded to keep away from being judgmental. That's the overview. What this leads to is, and there's much more to say about it, and I can only refer you again to other discussions, is that there are two opposite poles of spiritual existence in the world, Jew and non-Jew. They couldn't be more opposite. Male and female, human and non-human, animate and inanimate, east and west. There can't be a bigger difference spiritually than there is between Jew and non-Jew. They're completely different, not even species, completely different existences in the spiritual world. So much so that they can never bond, just as two men can never bond spiritually. And the world's confused about that too. But just as there's no possibility of connection between those two creatures invested in those two physical realities, so there's no possibility of a spiritual bond between a Jew and a non-Jewish, a Jewish soul, non-Jewish soul, while so long as they're invested in that form in those bodies. If a non-Jew converts to Judaism, there's a mitzvah to love them twice as much, a double mitzvah to love them. They become as Jewish as any other Jew, in many ways even greater. But until that time, it's not possible to form a bond. The other side of this coin is the understanding of what marriage is. And that, again, is too... We can't hope to even scratch the surface of that subject. Just we'll extract one element out of that discussion that we need here. You referred here to the discussion on the mystical background of marriage, what it means, bonding of male and female into a harmony. And there are at least four recordings in the library that deal with that subject, two sets dealing with marriage. But for purposes of this discussion, the elements that we need are as follows. I'm going to try and share with you an idea now that's almost impossible for us to hear in Western terms. We have been so battered into thinking that we're just accidental versions of gorillas, that we look the way we do because of a few million years or a few billion years of bumping into each other in the jungle, that it's almost impossible for us to hear anything about a spiritual content. But the point is that the Jewish idea about marriage is that it's got nothing to do with the biological relationship. It's got everything to do with the biological relationship. Unless the vehicles can be brought into contact with each other, to proximity and contact, then the spiritual realities can't bond at all. But the marriage element of that bond, the marriage, what we call the marriage element of that bond, what in Hebrew is called kiddushin, that's the bonding of spiritual essences. And only that. Let's see if we can try and understand this a little bit more deeply. The idea of marriage. Again, in English, the word doesn't mean anything. Marriage in English means marriage. It might as well be called mating. But the word kiddushin, we don't have a word for that in Hebrew. The word we have for marriage is called kiddushin. Kiddushin means sanctification. It's not a euphemistic way of referring to this relationship. That's exactly what the relationship is. Right? The concept of marriage is that when a man takes a woman to himself to form a bond, the verb used is mekadesh. That means he sanctifies her. To live together with a woman, if you could live together with a woman in such a way that there's no sanctity between you, that is called degrading a woman. That physical use that's made of her is a degradation of what she is. The only way that can ever be allowed is to take that level, the most physical level of the vehicle, and raise it to the most sublime levels of sanctification. And that's what the word Kiddushin means. So we don't have any concept of being together biologically or physically. That's irrelevant. Of course that can be done, but it's got nothing to do with marriage. One of the biggest travesties in this area is that Jews who don't know this want to live together with a non-Jew, and they think, they understand somewhere from the depths of their consciousness, they're completely lacking the element of the difference between a Jew and a non-Jew, but they're not lacking the element of the fact that you need what's called marriage. So they'll do anything, you know, in order to call it a marriage. They'll go anywhere to get a certificate, even if it means going to the enemy, in order to have something that they can call a marriage. It would be much better to live together in an animal fashion, without any pretenses. That's spiritual death too, but it would be a lot better than making a travesty of spirituality and reducing it to that's what we understand to be the idea of marriage. We understand that you have two opposite elements spiritually that are completely able to enmesh with each other. Every spiritual magnetic element in the one is mixing, enmeshing with an opposing, opposite force in the other on a myriad of levels in the personality, just like the body. And those two mesh into one being, and that's what we call Kiddushin. That's where sanctification rests. The concept of having a relationship that's based on the spiritual, that requires that the two elements, the two spiritual elements, are able to make such a relationship. The only way that can be done is between a Jewish man who has to be fully a man and a Jewish woman who has to be fully a woman. There is a concept of spiritual bonding between non-Jew and non-Jew also, between a non-Jewish man and a non-Jewish woman. There is such an element, and it's also called marriage. It doesn't have the same words and definition that we relate to, because their entire spiritual being is a different one, but there is such a concept. But to cross the borderline, to cross the wires from one to the other, is impossible spiritually. It's not that it's forbidden, it's impossible. Those are the two basic elements that we need to understand. So the first thing that we need to extract out of the discussion is that if any young person, any Jewish person, tells you or is considering marrying a non-Jew, the first thing they have to know, if they want to be honest about the situation, is that no one can stop them living together, and if they want to do that, we believe in free choice. We don't have the power to prevent such things. But marriage, it certainly isn't. Let's look briefly at the next level, which is, people often want to know, what technically is the halakhic prohibition? What exactly, where does it say that one may not, so to speak, marry a non-Jew? Where does it say that? So it says as follows. First of all, you should know that the responsibility here is on the Jew, not the non-Jewish partner. The responsibility, and I'm only speaking here, to the Jewish party, to this relationship. There's no place in the canon of non-Jewish law, as Torah defines it, where it says that a non-Jew may not marry a Jew. Yes, there are opinions, and it's certainly true, that when a non-Jew marries a Jew, they are causing, they're leading them astray, which itself is a terrible sin in its own right. Because they're causing them to be wasting their lives. They're causing that Jewish person to be blasting their deepest spiritual energy into a complete wasteland. Because out of that will never come a future generation. That's connected to the previous. I'm trying to explain that also. But what they're guilty of, what a non-Jew is guilty of in marrying a Jew, is of giving that Jew the opportunity to perform this avera, this sin, and to waste their lives in this fashion. The specific prohibition is on the Jewish partner, who is forbidden to marry a non-Jew. And here there are a number of levels of prohibition. Very generally, because it's a deep and learned halakhic issue, but very generally, we understand as follows. First of all, it's certainly a biblical prohibition, there's no question about it, in addition to levels of rabbinic prohibition. Where is the biblical prohibition is an interesting debate among halakhic authorities. The Rambam holds that it's contained in the mitzvah of what's called loisis chaten bam, which means that you shall not marry them, which is phrased in Chumash that way. The Rambam clearly understands this idea to mean not just an intimate relationship. The Rambam understands that the biblical prohibition is of setting up a permanent relationship with a non-Jewish woman or a non-Jewish man. He clearly writes the derech ishus, which means in the way of a marriage. He doesn't write marriage because there can be no marriage between Jew and non-Jew. But he writes that when two people set up a relationship that ostensibly or superficially has the ingredients of what the non-Jewish world would call a common law marriage, in other words, two people are committed to each other, they spend their time together, they invest their lives in the confines of one home, that is what's prohibited, quite apart from the intimate side of the relationship, which is the specific prohibition. Of course, the halacha understands that any time two people, male and female, spend time alone together, there is always assumed to be an intimate relationship as well. But the Rambam's concept here is that what's forbidden is not only the intimate relationship, but the setting up of a home together on a so-called ostensibly permanent basis. That's what's prohibited. The others disagree, but that's the idea we have. Secondly, there's clearly a most awesome prohibition against an intimate relationship between Jew and non-Jew. It's got nothing to do with the impurity or spiritual damage of other forbidden sexual relationships. It could even be that a non-Jewish woman doesn't have a state of nidah. She doesn't even have what a Jewish woman has in terms of spiritual impurity during menstruation. It's not that kind of problem. It's a different kind of spiritual death. The punishment for the intimate relationship is certainly lashes, no question about it. It's a love in the Torah. The spiritual punishment, in addition to the physical punishment of lashes, is excision of the neshama. That means that the complete loss of a spiritual soul, of a Jewish soul, complete excision from the spiritual source. Technically, it means dying young as well, in case you need extra motivation to find the strength to prevent this. It literally means dying young too. That's what the punishment specifically and technically means. And probably childless too. With the children in existence, they may die. How do we see the severity of this? There's a prohibition that says as follows. There is a unique prohibition here that I don't think that you don't have by any other commandment in the Torah. It's so awesome that it's hard to speak about, but let me try. There is a law in the Torah that's called Kanoim Poigimbo. Let me try and explain this. Apart from the idea of setting up a relationship between a Jew and a non-Jew, apart from that, and apart from the prohibition of an intimate physical relationship between Jew and non-Jew, there is another specific law which states that if a Jew and a non-Jew, it's taught specifically in the case of a Jewish man having an intimate relationship with a non-Jewish woman, but the post can bring that it works both ways. There's a specific law that if a Jew is engaged in such an activity with a non-Jew, and they are currently, right now, engaged in this physical act, in public, and in public does not mean it has to be in view of other people. It means all poskim agree that other people know about it. And living together in the privacy of a home is considered public. That means, let's be clear about this, does not only mean an act of fornication that is publicly witnessed by 10 Jews. It doesn't mean that. It means an act of sexual intimacy that is known about by at least 10 Jews. And knowing about it means that if Jews know that this couple live together, then the presumption that they have an intimate relationship halachically is so well founded that all authorities agree that that's tantamount to public knowledge of the intimate side of the relationship. So, this is the result. If a Jew and non-Jew are engaged in an act of physical intimacy that other people know about, even if they don't witness this act, then any Jew, a Jew, is entitled to come upon them and kill them in the act. That's called kanon poigimbo. Without a based in, without recourse to a court of law, that's the nature, that's the depth of this act. That's what it means spiritually. There's no other law in the Torah like that. You should know that we don't do that, because the Gemara says, or Moshe Feinstein, other posts can bring, that there's a prerequisite to this act, and that is you have to be pure yourself. You're not allowed to carry out this act unless you are perfectly pure. Can't take the law into your own hands this way. There's another limitation that if someone asks this question, they are not to be told to do it. That means if somebody asks a question in Beis Din, that in such and such a place I know of a Jew and a non-Jew who are presently engaged in this act, may I go and kill them? The answer is that we do not. We do not rule that way. It says, Halacha ba'en morim kain. The law is that he may, but we don't rule that way. However, if a Jew does kill them, summarily execute them on the spot, then he is acting in accordance with the halacha. We're not discussing this halacha tonight because it has practical application. We're discussing it because a Jew should understand how far this issue goes. It's learned from the act of Pinchas, who was aware that Cosby and Zimri, Zimri being a prince of the tribe of Shimon, was engaged in his tent in the midst of the Jewish camp in an act of physical intimacy with Cosby, a woman of Midian, a princess of Midian. And he went and asked Moshe Rabbeinu what the law was, and Moshe didn't answer, and he said, didn't you once tell us that they may be killed, that it's an avenging of Hashem's honor, because this is a defection from the intimacy that we and Hashem are supposed to experience together. This is a Jew taking his most intimate level of his being and giving it elsewhere, outside of the sanctity of our relationship with Hashem. Didn't you say that we can kill him? And Moshe said, let the one who brings the letter read it. And he went into the tent and he killed them in such a way that I'm squeamish to mention the details. You can look it up in the Mefarshim yourself, but the point is that he killed them in such a way that it was apparent to all what had been happening, and carried around their bodies on his spear the way they had been before through the camp so that everybody could see. If that's not enough, there is another comment in Chazal that says as follows, that no matter how bad a Jew is, no matter what a Jew has done in life, see if we can try and understand these ideas, no matter how bad a Jew has been, so there is a remarkable Kabbalistic mystical Chazal that says that at the moment that he's about to enter the dimension of suffering or retribution in the next world, at the entrance to that painful dimension of awesome experience of non-being and of suffering and of trying desperately to regrow the sensitivity that you should have had as a human being, as a Jew, at the last moment as a Jew is about to enter, he is plucked out of that entrance by Abraham Avinu. That's what it says. That means you can anticipate, as a Jew, you can anticipate walking towards the entrance of Gehenna, if you have done things that you shouldn't have done in life. If you are weighed more than 50% on the side of negativity, which is a judgment that occurs in Rosh Hashanah, you can anticipate, if you've done those things, if that's your balance, walking towards the entrance to Gehenna, and as you're about to enter, you will see sitting at the side of the entrance to Gehenna. In some of Hashem it says, just as he used to sit at the entrance to his tent in the heat of the day, Avraham Avinu is sitting there. And every Jew that comes that way, he plucks him out at the last moment and saves him. But there's one kind of Jew that he can't save, and that is Avol Aramus. A Jewish man who's had an intimate relationship with a non-Jewish woman. That man he can't save, he can't pull him out. Why not? Because he can't recognize him. You follow? It's not vindictive. It's because this individual has taken his inner spark, that which should have been an ongoing formative element in the Jewish people, that link in the chain that began with us as a Jewish people and will go to greet the Mashiach eventually, that man's taken that seed and diverted it into some other place that's irrelevant to us. So he's not part of that chain anymore. I think it says in Chazal there's another crime that also generates such a terrible lack of mercy, and it's a person who tries to undo his circumcision. A person who tries to reverse his breast. A man who tries to undo, which obviously doesn't take much imagination to see its connection and to see exactly why it's in the same category. If you want a sensible, logical, if you want an understanding of this Kabbalistic, of this mystical idea, the logic is something like this, that a person, the question to be asked here without too much detail, is why should a person be saved from the dimension of retribution in the next world, right, if he deserves to go there? You follow? Person did certain things, never mind marrying an non-Jew. Person did certain things that on balance require this dimension, this terrible suffering in the next world. Why should a person be saved from that experience because Abraham sits there? Now the answer is as follows. It's what we call Bris Avos. It's the covenant that Hashem made with Abraham that gives him the right to save his children and grandchildren. Bris, by the way, also means the kind of circumcision covenant. That's what it means. But the idea behind it is this, that you may not deserve it. You may not deserve, as an individual, you as a Jew who have not lived up to your responsibilities, you may not deserve to be saved from Gehenna. You may deserve to go in there and burn. But Avram Avinu doesn't deserve to see one of his grandchildren going through that. Even if the grandchild deserves it, he doesn't deserve it. That's what the covenant with him is. A man who could raise himself to the level of complete transcendence and could get to the Madraga, the level of being able to sacrifice a child when necessary. A person who could get to that superhuman level, so such an individual, even if his grandchild deserves to be punished, so that individual, Hashem has for him the kindness, the kindliness, that he saves him from the suffering. When a parent sees a child suffer, even if it's richly deserved, the parent goes through agony. The parent's not happy to see a child suffer even deservedly. And therefore Hashem made a covenant in which he promised that Avraham Avinu's merit would be so great that it would protect him from the suffering of seeing his children suffer. And therefore he's able to sit at that entrance and on his merit pull you out. It's like when a young teenager arrives at a very fashionable country club and is dressed in rags and smells bad, and the rules there require formal dress, and the doorman is about to sling him out of the precincts of the club, and the young teenager mentions his name, and his name is the same name as the founder of the club, so then they let him in. And they let him in not because he deserves it, but they let him in because that kind of name dropping, that kind of link to the source of things, is what saves a person. So Avraham Avinu, when another Jew who's a descendant of his comes that way, he's able to save him. But the exception is somebody who doesn't look like one of his children. The exception is someone who's taken that heritage and is completely dissolved. He's completely led it into not being a child of Avraham Avinu. Instead of fulfilling his obligation to at least be a child and then become a father to another child, he's taken that and stopped it. He's accepted the gift of being a child of Avraham Avinu, but then he takes the ability to become a father of a child of Avraham Avinu, and he diverts it elsewhere into people who have no connection with that source, so he can't be recognized. Let's try and look at another angle of this question. In this element of the discussion, you will find comfort if you are an individual who has made this mistake, or you're considering making this mistake, or you're linked to someone who is divesting themselves of any Jewish connection in this way. You'll find comfort and also frustration. Let me tell you the idea. We mentioned this, I think, once before in another context. Let me try and express it as we need it for now. To explain it, I have to tell you the story fully. Stay with me and you'll understand. I once heard my teacher say the following thing. He said he was once sitting with a great man. At the time, he didn't say the name of this man, so I'm not going to say it. But one of the leaders of the previous generation, one of the great sages of this generation, who's not alive anymore, a person with unbelievable, literally unbelievable insight into the ways of the world. And my teacher was sitting with this great Torah sage, and this great sage happened to say that he had been asked the following question. So the question was as follows. A young man had come to him sometime previously. This must have been at least 30 years ago. And this young man had asked him how a philosophy had swept Europe that made so little sense. That was the question. The question he wanted to know from this Torah sage was, how was it possible that a philosophy of social and economic function could have swept Europe starting in the beginning of the century? Now we've seen it collapse, of course. We know that it's foolish. We know it can't work. We know it's evil. But at the time that it swept Europe, this idea of social reform that would be the deliverance of the masses, the deliverance of the workers and society, and usher in the utopian ideal, how is it possible that an ethic so impossible and so against the nature of the human being had taken such hold in the mind of so many millions? And specifically what he wanted to know, listen well, was how could it have taken hold of the minds of intelligent Jews? There were Jews in that generation with plenty of Jewish insight and background. There were people in that generation with yeshiva background. There were people with tremendous Jewish learning behind them who were swept away by this philosophy. There were people who left the yeshivas. It's well known. There were people who, with an enlightenment type of ideology, they left the fold of Torah and they were swept after this new social ism in such a way that they were lost entirely. The Chofetz Chaim said at the time that it would last exactly 70 years, so he said, it would last exactly 70 years and would dissolve without a war. So how did he know that? How did he know that? So the answer is the same answer as this sage gave to this young man. When the young man explained, because he was a student of history and of human nature, and he couldn't understand how it could be that people with any insight and intelligence could have been swept away by such a flimsy, illusory experiment in human nonsense. So the sage answered him as follows. Remarkable answer, absolutely remarkable. And it's the key to this evening's discussion. He said as follows. Only Torah can yield a depth of understanding like this. He did not give him a social answer, did not trace for him the history and development of European consciousness out of the last two centuries. He answered him as follows. The Gemara says about these kind of situations the following thing. The Gemara says this. Achas b'shivim shana, if you hear this well, once every 70 years, see the connection with where the Chofetz Chaim knew this from, once every 70 years, a star rises, oile koichav, a star rises, shemate es hasaponim, that misleads the ship's captains. Listen carefully. That's what the Gemara says. That's all it says. Once every 70 years, in the celestial structure that you need to navigate by, a star rises and it's misplaced. There's a star that does not fit. It's not that you're misreading it and misperceiving where it should be. It means Hashem in his wisdom organizes the heavens in such a way that he takes a star and he puts it where you need to navigate. He puts that star in the wrong place. Deliberately. Deliberately. Again, it does not say that the instruments are faulty or the navigator is not looking correctly. It says that Hashem organizes the heavens in such a way that he puts a star into such a place that it misleads the captains of the ships. Of course, they shouldn't follow that star. They should see that it's inconsistent with the rest of the stars. It's a test. It's an ordeal. It's constructed that way once every 70 years as an ordeal so that they can be challenged and tested. That navigation should not be easy, which is what life's all about, that we're faced with ordeals. And those who lead, those who navigate, they look into the cosmic structure and they see a structure that's explicit and predictable and correct, and there's something out of order, and it's a challenge to them. And a great many people follow that misleading star. What does it mean? It means that if philosophy could have swept Europe, that swept away much of the Jewish people, as we all know, many of its greatest leaders were Jews, it swept them away not because there was some way of understanding it. There is no way to understand it. All the textbooks that will tell you how the time was ripe for such an event, and how sociologically and psychologically and politically and economically it made sense, it's all nonsense. The Jewish attitude is that it doesn't make any sense at all. It's specifically out of sync with everything. It specifically doesn't make sense, and therein lies its ordeal for you. Therefore, the answer that he gave this young man was, don't look for understanding. Do not look for political, social, etc. currents that led to such an inexplicable move. Look for a completely misleading, a philosophy that does not make sense, that specifically is out of sync with truth, with errors. And because it's out of sync, it will be disturbing and distorting, and people will fall for it. They'll fall for that illusion, for that ordeal. That's what he said. Then my teacher said, when he said that, I said to him, I'm trying to repeat for you the words as closely as I can translate them. When he said this explanation to this young man, when he told me that he had said that, I said to him, Rebbe, what is the star that's misleading this generation? And he said to me, I think it's the blurring of the distinction between Jew and non-Jew. That's what he said. What does this mean? It means that until this generation's star rose, the difference between the Jew and the non-Jew was so embedded, blazed into the blood of Jewish consciousness that it didn't need any explanation. Any Jew of the previous generation, no matter where he stood, politically and psychologically and socially, the difference between Jew and non-Jew was such an essential basic element of his bloodstream that it didn't require any discussion. And in this generation you find Jews who can't understand what that means. Not through any fault of their own. Not necessarily because they have voluntarily thrown it away. I'm going to try and show you, time permits, that they're still accountable, in my opinion. That they should know better. They should be able to tell, even if they don't have the inner feeling for this issue, they should be able to tell by external signs that they're turning their back on everything that's precious. But what's for sure is that there's an element that's inexplicable. Let me try and illustrate this for you. The best way I know how is to tell you a story of someone I was associated with. I studied with a young lady who came from a Jewish home, she and her sister. One of the most difficult things I ever had to deal with in terms of understanding in my life. I knew this young lady quite well. She came from a certain home, and I used to visit that home. In that home, there was not a vestige of Jewishness. There were not candlesticks that I ever saw. I never saw a siddur. There was no mezuzah on the door. The two girls were sent to the local government school. There was a Jewish day school, incidentally, which I'm not suggesting is the answer to this problem. But nevertheless, there was a Jewish day school equally close. The two girls were sent to a non-Jewish school. I never heard a word of Jewishness mentioned in the house. I never saw a vestige of anything Jewish at all, not even the most superficial remnant of anything Jewish. There was no cheder. There was no Jewish input or experience or education at all. Remarkably so. This girl's elder sister married a non-Jew, and her father disowned her. At the time that I knew this young lady, her older sister had been married for 2.5 years, and the father had not seen her, and he'd not seen his grandchild. He'd completely rejected her, he refused to speak to her, he would never see her, and he wouldn't see his grandchild. And her mother had only recently been visiting her sister in secret, that the father shouldn't know, and she herself was meeting her sister in secret. Now, when that happened to me, I was completely at a loss to explain it. How could a person be so sensitive? How could a person be so insensitive to anything Jewish, and when his daughter marries a non-Jew, to take it so badly? But they say, from where did he take the feeling that he had a right to behave that way? The man provided nothing for his daughter. He gave her no input at all, never mentioned anything Jewish, and when she married a non-Jew, which is what he thrust her into, he behaved in such a remarkable fashion. But the answer is obvious after this evening's discussion. The answer is that he came from a generation where you didn't need any input to feel this. You didn't need any discussion or education. His consciousness of being a Jew and his consciousness of what a non-Jew was in spiritual terms and the impossibility of marrying a non-Jew. Never mind that. Not talking about negative emotion about it, about feeling negative about non-Jews. Not talking about that. I'm doing his gut level feeling that you just can't marry. That it's something that a Jew cannot do, not only does not, he cannot do, was so intense that he couldn't believe, he couldn't relate to, couldn't understand at all that there could be a human being, a Jew, who doesn't understand it that way. And of course they had no communication. There was no way, and if you look at families like that, you'll see that the parents go through an agony that's indescribable. When parents who from a generation that still does have this feeling experience the ordeal, the trial, of children relating to non-Jews or marrying non-Jews, you'll see that the parents' biggest agony is that they can't find the words to explain to the child what the problem is. And the child challenges the parents. The child says, but explain to me what's the problem. I can't see a difference. It's a fine young man or young woman. This person will look after me, will provide me with a good relationship. You yourself agree that's a fine young individual, as often happens. So what exactly is the problem? Well, you don't observe yourself. You don't keep any Jewish laws. You haven't shown me anything spiritual about it. I don't feel anything spiritual about it. It's a sort of cultural type identity, it's a national identity. And the parents can't find the words to explain. And the truth is, it's not because the parents are inarticulate, it's because there aren't any words to explain it. There are no words to explain the difference between Jew and non-Jew. There's only a way to feel it, and nothing can be felt more strongly. And therefore, there are no words to explain why it shouldn't be done. And there are no words to explain why you can't feel it. That's the comfort and the frustration. The comfort is to know that if you fell into such a situation, you must be one of those individuals. You must be one of those individuals who does not have a natural gut-level feeling about the impossibility, the curdling effect on the blood of Jew and non-Jew who try to get together in that way. You can't feel that. That's the solace. The frustration is that I've no idea how to regain that, how to regrow that sensitivity. Certainly can't be done overnight. How to re-strike, how to strike the flame again of that inner feeling that the Jewish people have had for every single generation of Jewish history until this one, until this 70-year star has risen. How to rekindle that flame, I've no idea. You either have it or you don't. It's too much of a stretch of my credibility and imagination to believe that anybody who has that feeling would throw it away for a pretty face. Let's look at the next level. Let's say a person doesn't have that feeling. I'll try and share with you the feeling of tremendous negativity of people who have to deal with this situation. Feeling of breathless agony on the part of parents who have to deal with children who go through this experience, or counselors or people who deal with this. Let me try and share it with you. Here's a young Jew. They become attracted to somebody who's not Jewish. They shouldn't have been there in the first place, of course. They shouldn't have been close enough to get engaged in that kind of relationship. The tragedy of our situation, of course, is that our young people get involved in these relationships not by design. That credit you have to give them. They do not have the problem of young Jews going out deliberately and specifically looking for a non-Jew to marry. We don't have that anymore. There was a time, and you still have a vestige of it in some older people, where there was a shame felt in being Jewish. And there was a tremendous admiration of a goy, of what it means to be a non-Jew. Tremendous admiration. And you have people who had a fixation about that, and specifically kept away from the Jewish community, and specifically desired to marry a non-Jew because they're non-Jewish. It's well known. You have a well-known Israeli politician today. His one child married to an Arab, another child married to a Christian. And he makes a big fuss about it because he's tremendously proud. It's well known he helps missionaries to draw Jewish children away from their Jewish heritage. And I once heard, when this became a public issue, a great Torah sage explained that this man's problem is that he's caught in the grip of a tremendous admiration of the non-Jewish world. It's a tremendous feeling of a vacuum about what it means to be Jewish. That's very uncommon these days. Almost none, if any, of the marriages or relationships that you find among young people today is because the young person admires being non-Jewish and wants a non-Jewish husband or wife. That's not the point. The point is that they fell into the relationship by accident, which is not the way Jews go about contracting marriage. We make a very conscious decision about whom we want to meet with a view to marriage. But this person was at university, or they were in some environment where they got close to some very nice and becoming non-Jewish individual, and a relationship developed. Emotional bond there certainly can be between Jew and non-Jew. And so they got caught in the throes of usually a physical relationship, and not so usually a physical and emotional relationship. And that's what led to the situation. That's not how we go about relationships in the first place. But let's say you've gotten into that situation, or you know someone who is. The feeling that we would have about this, and the feeling that we would try intensely to convey to this young person, if we could only do so, and I've never been able to do it face to face with such an individual in private because it's too much of an accusation, and I'll take the chance of doing it now. And that is to briefly, just briefly, run through for them the briefest of overview of Jewish history. Just simply to tell them what's been sacrificed to be here today as a Jew. I'm not going to agonize you with a whole elaborate description of the history of this, but remind yourself just briefly of each generation of Jews, homeless people in each generation for the last over 2,000 years, were terrorized and tortured because they were Jewish, butchered because they were Jewish, who went voluntarily through torture and butchery, not forced into it, voluntarily went through those agonies to remain Jewish and to have children who were Jewish. There are modern commentaries who point out that the first time ever in Jewish history that Jews were butchered without being given a choice was in this generation, because they really made the wrong choice. That so many of us had already made the wrong choice. But it's the first time it ever happened. That means Hashem's confidence in his people being able to withstand torture was so great throughout Jewish history that he was able to put Jews through an ordeal of offering them the chance to reject their Jewishness and accept somebody else's identity in order to save their lives and their bodies from mutilation. And generation after generation of Jewish people, men, women, little children, chose to go through torture time and again, protracted torture, rather than pretend to accept anything of anybody else's. I'm not making this up. I'm not trying to be dramatic about it. I'm not exaggerating. You can check it out for yourself. You can go through the descriptions of our enemies about what it was like. You can read descriptions of the Inquisition. You can see what protracted torture was applied to little Jewish children in order to make them not because they were sadistic individuals who wanted to torture us, they may have been sadistic too, but the reason they did this to us was to try to get a Jew to convert from Judaism to something else. How many Jewish communities in the 1600s, the 1700s, the early 1800s, how many communities weren't burnt down entirely, to the last person? When given a choice, all you have to do is come out of your shul, kiss the cross, and you can go home. Not only go home, we'll honor you, we'll give you everything you want. And they chose to burn to death, families sitting together in the shul, burnt to death without an attempt to open the door, rather than pretend to accept anybody else's system. Their love for Hashem and for his Torah, the fire that burned in their blood that was ignited at Sinai, was so powerful that they would have happily, they sat singing, burned to death as a community, than even fleetingly pretend to give credibility to anybody else's system. Some quote figures that say that the Catholic Church killed more Jews than were killed in this generation, and they weren't killed efficiently as most Jews were in this generation. They were killed by torture, again, because the object wasn't to kill them, the object was to convert them. And millions were killed because they died in torture, not because they were killed because they were Jews. That never happened. That never happened. What happened was an attempt to convert them to Islam, to Christianity. You can read the documents of the Inquisition, not our testimonies. You can read theirs. They had a favorite trick. I'm not going to go into detail. I'll just tell you one. In the early part of the 1400s, the Spanish had a trick where they would take a Jew and tie him horizontally with his feet over a fire. They would cut the soles of his feet and put butter in and roast his feet over a fire. That was called a bastinado. That was done to countless numbers of Jewish children who withstood that rather than say that they would become a Christian. That's why you're here tonight. That's why I'm here. Because they went through that. And you turn your back on that? You turn your back on